Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. Very pleased to welcome Dave Willis to the program. Dave is the author of The 7 Laws of Love, Essential Principles for Building Stronger Relationships. Dave Willis, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. It's an honor to be here.
Now, Dave, you are a pastor as well as the founder of StrongerMarriages.org. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that is correct. My wife and I work together. We've been working with married couples online and in person for about a decade now, and it's been a fun journey.
And certainly you are the author of The 7 Laws of Love. And, you know, what strikes me about one of the things that struck me as I was just looking at the cover, where the subtitle is Building Stronger Relationships, we're certainly in a world nowadays where I'm just not sure that relationships are seen in the same way they've been seen in the past. I'm not sure they're given the generosity of spirit, if you will, that has perhaps historically been a given. What's your thought?
I think you're exactly right. I think that we've become more consumeristic as a culture, and then we've taken that consumerism and we've applied it to our relationships. You know, for me personally, I don't like to have the same cell phone for more than 2 years. And sometimes I think we'll take that same mindset and we'll apply it to people in our lives. It's kind of, you know, how are you making me feel right now? What have you done for me lately? And if I can trade you in for a different friend or a different partner that might be able to meet my needs better in this moment, then I'm going to do that. And so because of that, our relationships aren't rooted in commitment the way they once were. And without commitment at the foundation of a relationship, no relationship can really thrive and become all that it's meant to be. And I think that our culture, you know, for all the ways we've grown as a society, I think that's one way that one place where we've moved in the wrong direction is moving away from valuing commitment in our relationships.
Well, you begin your book with and I suspect just your whole philosophy with the concept that living well begins with loving well. And then you say a little bit later on, when you say I love you to someone, you aren't just expressing, as you've said, your current feelings. You are making a promise of commitment for a shared future. And for many people, a shared future, as we've said, is, you know, it might not even be 2 years, the life of an average cell phone. It might be 2 weeks or 2 months. 2 years is a long-term relationship for a lot of folks.
True. It's definitely true. And the nature of the relationship is going to be different. I mean, your relationship and level of loyalty to, you know, in a business relationship is obviously going to look different than in a friendship. And a friendship is going to look different than a marriage relationship or a relationship with a sibling or a child. So, you know, the nature of the relationship has a lot to do with it. But with all of them, one thing that holds true is that the strength of our commitment will always determine the strength of that relationship. And so I think that when we say I love you, you know, those words, you know, I love you, we throw them around so loosely, and I'm guilty of it too. You know, I say I love ice cream, I love this, I love that, and I'll throw it around loosely even in relationships. But to pause and consider what we're really saying, that love by its very nature, it isn't just a feeling. It isn't just saying I like you. It isn't just saying I enjoy our time together, even though that's certainly a part of it. But it's making a promise about the future. You know, like you just pointed out, it's saying, I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to be by your side. You can count on me. And that's essentially what love means, more than anything else, more than the feeling, more than all those other things. Because our feelings are so fickle that if our relationships are only based on feelings, they're never going to have a solid foundation. But when we root them in that commitment of saying, you know what, you can count on me, even if it's a friend on the other side of the country, you don't see them that often, but if they call you and they have a need and it's been a year since you've talked, it's still that commitment is there to say, call me anytime, you can count on me, because that's what being in a strong relationship really means.
And, you know, what I think about is you said that you throw around the words, "I love ice cream," which, by the way, I understand completely. But
and I do love ice cream, by the way, just for the record.
But you know, as I was thinking about that, somebody might say, "I love ice cream, I love chocolate," and they are absolutely committed to loving that thing, that food,
sure,
for years, and it doesn't occur to them to back away from that commitment, that love for that thing or that food, but not right. So much with people.
It's true. That's a great point. Not all of our commitments are necessarily healthy ones. So
indeed.
That's a great point.
you talk in your book about Harold and Louise. And Harold and Louise were married for 70 years, which is kind of hard to even imagine. And you describe them as always kind of having a sparkle in their eye every time they looked at each other. How is that possible?
Well, I asked them the same question, because it's certainly what we all want to know. When we see a couple that's been together that long, and they clearly, you know, don't look the same way I'm sure that they looked when they first walked down the aisle and pledged their lives to each other. And so this relationship is grown to be so much more than just, you know, physical attraction and connection, and yet they seem more in love now than ever before. And that's what I think we all desire, you know, in terms of a romantic relationship, a marriage. And so I asked them the same question, which is something I make a habit of doing whenever I'm around a healthy couple or a couple that seems like they love each other and like each other too. I say, what's the secret? What can you teach me? And that's something I asked of them. And Louise, she kind of got a sparkle in her eye, and she smiled and she said, well, there's more than just one secret, but I will tell you a big part of it. She said it really comes down to consistency. And the example she gave, she said, I'll tell you a story to let you know what I mean. She said, on the 1 month anniversary of our first date all those years ago, Harold brought me a rose. And I said, what's this for? And he said, well, this month has been the best month of my life. I've loved every minute of being together. I'm just so honored that you're in my life. I'm excited about what the future might hold, and I just want to celebrate this first month together. And she smiled, thought, well, that's really sweet. Well, a month later, he does it again, and she says, what's this? And he said, well, it's been 2 months since our first date, and I just want to stop and reflect on these 2 months together. I've loved every minute of it. And so she smiled and thought, well, this fellow's a keeper. So time went on, and they got married, and she thought, well, now we're married, so surely that's going to stop. He's got me. The chase is over. He doesn't need to keep, you know, pursuing me. He's probably going to, you know, go from being thoughtful and romantic to just putting all that on the back burner. But sure enough, that first month of their marriage, on the anniversary of that first date, he brought another rose. And she smiled, and she looked up at him. She was in a wheelchair at this point, but looked up at him, still had that sparkle in her eye, just like a teenager in love. And she said it, at that point in the story, she said, it's been 646 months since our first date, and he has never once forgotten to bring me a rose. And honestly, I felt like a jerk when she said that, because I'm thinking, my poor wife, I love as much as I love her. I don't think I've ever done anything that thoughtful and romantic for that length of time. So it really challenged me to not just try to copy their tradition, but to think about, what are those habits? What are those consistent things that I'm doing to invest into my marriage, into the relationships that matter most? Because really, it is what we do with consistency in any part of life that ultimately makes the difference and defines that relationship. And so I don't want to just be thoughtful every now and then. I want to be consistent. I want to make sure that I'm prioritizing my wife, my children, my friends, those people that matter most, and letting them know by the way I spend my time, by the words that I speak to them, how much of a priority they are to me. So yeah, Harold and Louise have been a big inspiration in that way.
Well, if you haven't done so already, I'm hoping that as soon as we finish our conversation, you put a monthly rose on auto delivery so you don't get caught up again.
That's a great idea.
You're welcome. That, you know, as you describe that story, I mean, it almost brings a tear to one's eye, because it's just so loving, so gentle, so consistent, and so respectful of the union and each other. It's a lovely story.
Well, thank you. It touched me as well. You know, it's not always those big romantic gestures, even though those can be nice, that make the biggest difference. It's those little things done with great love and great thoughtfulness and consistency that tend to mean the most in the end.
Now, when you say consistency, are you saying that commitment and consistency are the same thing, or are they spokes of the same wheel, or are they completely different from your perspective?
I think that consistency is always part of commitment. It's how we show our commitment. So commitment that's the foundation. You know, that's what it's all built on. Consistency of our actions is really the way we communicate and display that foundation. And so they're two different things, but they very much go hand in hand. So if you're committed to someone, you're going to consistently be there for them, whatever that looks like, depending on the nature of the relationship. And so we can't just say I love you, if that's all that we do in that relationship. But we have to really be willing through our actions, through our time, to display our love, and to do it with consistency. And the more we do that, the stronger the bond we're going to have with that person, and the stronger that foundation of commitment that holds the relationship up is going to be.
Now, there are people, as we well know in the world, who think that commitment and consistency really needs to be the thing that you bring to yourself. That relationships with other people, they come, they go, whatever, whatever. But as long as I'm good with me, I'm good. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I think you certainly do have to have, you have to have self-confidence. You have to love yourself. In fact, there's a whole chapter in this book on what that really means to love yourself. The last half of the book talk about our seven most important relationships and how to love well in each of those. And one of those is all about what you just pointed out. What does it really mean to love yourself? Because when we have a right view of who we are, who we were created to be, then it brings all these other things into focus. Now, the trick is, in that quest of loving ourselves well and having self-confidence, to not let narcissism and pride creep in, because it's easy to cross that line, and all of a sudden loving ourselves turns into this very prideful approach to life, where we live as if the world is a reality show all about us, and everybody else in the world is just a supporting character in this story that's all about us, or we're the star all the time. And if we live that way, then it makes any healthy relationship with ourselves or with anyone else really difficult, because pride gets in the way. And we've got to be willing, as much as we love ourselves, to lay that pride down for the sake of others and to be humble. And I've heard it described that being humble doesn't mean thinking less of yourself. It just means thinking of yourself less. And in our world, it teaches us to be very, very self-promoting, very, very self-centered. I think the healthiest relationships, and people really that even have the healthiest relationship with themselves, are people that have discovered that truth of being humble instead of prideful, where they don't have low confidence. In fact, they have a lot of confidence, but they also realize that life isn't all about them, and that they need to serve, and sometimes selflessly serve, the people around them. And so that's the key there. And it's difficult to do, and it's a daily struggle, because all of us, you know, wrestle with selfishness. But that's the goal.
The idea of commitment, I just want to stay with that for a little bit longer. You have said that it requires abandoning our exit strategies. You know, as I share this with you and with the audience, I'm reminded some time ago when I did a workshop, and one of the participants of the workshop said, if she doesn't get an I love you within 90 days, she's done. So, you know, she's out of the relationship. So clearly she was somebody who had a 90-day or less exit strategy. You're saying that commitment means you have to give up your exit strategy. That's a very scary thought for some folks.
Oh, it's incredibly scary. And when I say that, I just want to kind of give the disclaimer here. I know a lot of people that are listening to this program, you've been through broken relationships, you've been divorced, and many of those divorces, I'm sure, had very good reason. You were in an abusive situation. You were in a situation where there was just this habitual pattern of broken trust, and the situation, the circumstances of that relationship just made it impossible to continue on with the relationship, because the relationship had just completely dissolved or broken through a lot of circumstances that may have been completely out of your control. So when I talk about these things, I lift up the value of commitment and throwing away exit strategies. Well, I think that, yes, absolutely, that is the goal, and that is what, when two people are committed to that, what makes a healthy relationship thrive for a lifetime. I'm in no way trying to shame or beat up on those who have come through some very, very difficult circumstances. You don't need to feel bad about that. It's looking right now, the relationships in your life, especially the marriage relationship, which is close to my heart, my wife's heart, just something that we feel called to do with our lives, is to really encourage people in their marriages, is that when those marriages work, when we've learned from people like Harold and Louise who've made it, for a lifetime, and they've made it as partners, hand in hand and side by side, what we've learned from them is that they're not the couples who never had a reason to get divorced. They're simply the ones whose commitment to each other was always bigger than their reasons to get divorced. They were unapologetically committed to one another, and they chose to love each other even on the days where they may have struggled to like each other. Because the thing about love is you can choose through your commitment to give it to someone. And we understand this instinctively when it relates to children. I mean, if I only loved my children on the days they were being lovable, there would be lots of days that I did not love them at all, you know, when they are just not listening, they're getting in trouble, and I'm thinking, my goodness, what is wrong? And yet we love them. You know, we love them the moment they're placed in our arms, before they've done anything to earn it. We love them enough to give our lives to them, for them, in that moment. And so we get it in that kind of relationship. But when it comes to, you know, a relationship like a marriage, where it's two people that are choosing each other and feelings, you know, we have to grow into them, unlike, you know, with a child where you just kind of instinctively have some of those. But yet in that marriage, we have to have that same level of commitment for it to work, to say, you know what, let's remove the word divorce from our vocabulary. Let's not use that as ammunition in arguments. Let's not say, well, I'm out of here, you know, if I can do so much better. But we're going to choose to work through this together, because every disagreement we have, because we're united, we're not going to see the disagreement as something where one of us is going to win and one of us is going to lose. But instead, we're going to see the disagreement as something where we're either going to win together or lose together every time. We're going to share the same fate. We're on the same team. So when we have a fight, it's not against each other. It's for each other. And yeah, we're going to disagree, because a marriage requires unity, but not uniformity. We're not always going to have the same opinion. But even in those disagreements, we're going to resolve to have mutual respect. We're going to have thoughtfulness. We're going to lift each other up instead of tearing each other down. And we're going to have each other's back. And again, it's a marriage of two imperfect people, so we fail at that. Nobody meets that standard 100% of the time. But the couples that, again, that make it work, the Harold and Louises out there, we've just seen through observation and learning from couples like that's the mindset they take. We're in this together. Whatever life throws our way, we're going to face it together and not against each other. And so that's the goal, and that's really what I'm talking about when I say, you know, remove all exit strategies, is look for ways to fight for each other instead of against each other.
And the concept of unity, not uniformity, I think is also important. Dave, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue discussing the 7 laws of love. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Dave, you gave the example and made the distinction with the concept of commitment requiring the abandonment of exit strategies that was very important. I just want to underscore it for a moment. You made it very clear that for those folks who are in a relationship that is completely untenable, there's abuse, there may be completely negative chaos inside the unit, that those are not the relationships that necessarily need to be maintained, and perhaps an exit strategy would make sense in those situations. I think that's so important to underscore. So thank you for doing that.
And yes, and thank you for pointing that out again. I'm in no way saying that this commitment could cause this martyrdom, for lack of a better word, in a relationship where you are staying in a place where there is abuse of any kind, where there is this pattern of just habitual broken trust. Because when the other person is choosing to do those things, they are choosing to break that commitment in a way that a relationship is no longer possible when they're living that way. So yes, there are certainly circumstances when the healthiest thing is to create some space and to make sure that physically and emotionally that you're in a safe place. And if that person is no longer a safe place for you, then it might be time to put some distance between you and them.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the marshmallow test.
Yes.
Tell us about the marshmallow test. It's a good thing it wasn't ice cream. That's all I'm saying.
If it was ice cream, I'm afraid I would fail. It is my weakness. It's the reason I have love handles.
Okay.
Is ice cream. So the marshmallow test is a fascinating study. 1972, Stanford University. They did a groundbreaking study that's been redone many times over. And essentially the test was they brought children from all walks of life, all socioeconomic backgrounds, into a room, and they said, here's the test. It's real simple. You put a marshmallow in front of you. You can have this marshmallow right now. It is your marshmallow. If you want to eat it, you can eat it. But if you're willing to wait until I get back, then not only can you have this marshmallow, but I will give you an extra marshmallow. You will get two marshmallows if you are willing to wait. One now or two later. That was the whole test, and then they would just leave the room, and then cameras were set up, and they would just watch to see what the kids would do. And it's so funny. There are pictures online, even videos. You can watch these kids anguishing over the temptation of this marshmallow. They want to eat it right then, and some do. Some just gobble it up right away. Some wait a while, and then their willpower fades, and they gobble it up. And then there are others that, you know, they get up, they walk around. They didn't have to sit there and keep staring at the temptation. There were toys in the room to play with. And others just said, you know, that's not an option for me right now. I know I want two marshmallows, so I'm not just going to stare at the temptation. I'm going to go play. And they did, and they would play. They would occupy themselves. And for those that waited, the researcher would come back and say, congratulations, you did it. Here are two marshmallows. And so the test in itself doesn't seem like, you know, all that groundbreaking. But what was groundbreaking about it is that they actually followed those kids from 1972 into adulthood, and they made some noticeable differences in the trends of the lifestyle choices of the one marshmallow kids versus the two marshmallow kids. And basically, the kids that had been prone to just instantly gobble up what was right in front of them without waiting on the better option, those kids were more likely to be in, you know, unstable relationships and unstable careers and unstable financial circumstances. The kids that had waited, had the willpower to wait for the second marshmallow, they were more likely to be in a stable marriage. They're more likely to be in a stable job, more likely to, you know, to have just overall health and quality of life. And so the researchers made this like stunning claim that the key, the number one indicator that would lead to a person's long-term success in their relationships and really in every part of their life was simply the ability, the discipline to delay gratification. And for me as a parent, that has so many profound implications because, you know, our world is just throwing stuff at our kids, and our kids think they need all this stuff right now, and
right.
they, they, you know, they have a touch of their fingertips on smartphones. They've got access to the world, and to teach delayed gratification and patience in this kind of world is difficult, but it's so important, because when we're willing to wait, when we're willing to say, you know what, I could have something that's good now, but I could have something that's so much better if I'm willing to wait. That has huge implications, I think, in our relationships. And I feel like that mindset of being able to delay gratification, it can prevent us from rushing into unhealthy relationships just because, you know, we're feeling lonely, and it causes us to rush into something that isn't necessarily healthy, when instead we could say, you know what, I'm going to wait for a healthy opportunity. I'm going to wait for a healthy person to come along. Even when we are married, it means saying, you know, I'm not going to have an affair. I'm not going to give in to some of the temptations that are out there in the world, because I know that temporary pleasure would lead to permanent regret. And so I'm going to wait. I'm going to resolve to choose a higher standard. And I think that there are so many times in life when, if we're willing to pass up on that temporary pleasure, that quick fix right in front of us, there's a better option when we're willing to wait.
All right. So far what we're really talking about, we've identified commitment, consistency, delayed gratification as pieces of a healthy, strong relationship. Let's talk about honesty. You know, there are all kinds of ways that honesty as a concept can be thrown at people. You offer some examples of your children being honest. It wasn't the greatest in the world. And then there are people, and I'd like you to share some of those, but there are also people who use the concept of honesty almost as a sledgehammer. You know, you are X, Y, and Z, and I'm just being honest with you. So I'd like you to respond to both, but let's start with some of those honest comments your children have made.
Sure. Well, honesty is of course so important in any relationship, and the level of your honesty will determine the level of your intimacy. I always say, you know, we've got to be honest. We've got to tell the truth. And so in teaching our kids this, to kind of is a parenting lesson. You know, we teach our kids, you've got to be honest. If you want to earn people's respect and trust and have healthy relationships, you've got to tell the truth. And so they would take that to, you know, the very literal sense, and they would just start shouting out anything they thought was true. Like, Dad, look, that man is so fat. And we'd say, you can't say that. And they'd say, Dad, but it's true. Or, Dad, look at that lady's ear. She looks like Yoda. And so you can't say that. And they'd say, but it's true. And so then we had to circle back and say, okay, well, here's the standard. The truth without love is just as dangerous as speaking a lie. In fact, we pointed to a verse in the Bible that says, speak the truth with love, and that we need both those things existing together, that we need to speak the truth, but we also need to do it motivated by the best intentions for everyone involved. And we still sometimes have to speak difficult truths to people that we love. We sometimes need to call each other out, but we need to do it in a way that's motivated by love and motivated by wanting to build a relationship instead of tearing it down. So the filter that we use, that we borrowed from another family, is we don't want to say anything unless it's three things: true, kind, and necessary. And if it's not all three, if it's not 100% true, if it's not kind, if there's not, you know, love motivating it, and if it's not necessary, if it's something that doesn't need to be said, and saying it could potentially cause harm, then there's really no point to say it. So if it's all three of those things, then yes, say it every single time. And that filter, and again, we fail at it. I, as a parent, do. My kids certainly do. But that's the filter. And just being able to identify the standard. So when they say something super mean about their brothers, which happens all the time, we say, now, is it true, kind of necessary? And they'll say, no, but it's true. And I'm like, yeah, maybe, but is it the other two? And it kind of helps keep us all in check.
So true, kind, and necessary actually are good concepts to live by. You say that part of loving someone else requires that you take an honest look at yourself. Why is that such a critical aspect of this?
Well, I think it's critical for, you know, for a lot of reasons. You know, we touched on early in the program about the need to love yourself well, but in loving yourself well, not being consumed in this kind of prideful, self-centered approach to life. I think as it relates to what we're talking about now, given an honest self-assessment, it's that if we're not careful, we can become experts at identifying the flaws in other people and blind to our own flaws. And when we get that way, it becomes really impossible to be in healthy relationships, because we just become everybody's critic. And then we feel like we're immune from that, because in our mind, we don't have nearly the same problems they do. We've become blind to it. And in fact, there's a little verse that I showed my kids where Jesus actually taught, we're so good at pointing at a plank or a 2x4, in somebody else's eye, when really they just have a speck of sawdust in their eye and the 2x4 is in our own eye. It's like we become experts at seeing this little thing that's wrong in other people, and we're blind to our own flaws. So the honest self-assessment means being willing, humble enough to look in the mirror and say, what are those places in my life that make me difficult to love? Where are those places in my life where I'm inconsistent, where I expect one thing of other people, but I'm not living by that same standard myself? And those are hard thoughts to have, hard conversations to have, and really even to get to a place where we're willing to out loud ask the people in our lives, like, is this an area, of weakness, or what are those places in my life or my lifestyle that are hardest for you to love in me? And again, those can be some really, really vulnerable conversations. But I also think that it can help us see some things in ourselves that we might not be seeing. And by seeing them, we can take steps to correct them.
And then it sounds like as you can see them and correct them, it actually leaves you more open to more love and respect for yourself and more love and respect in the partnership.
No, it's so true. It's just like pruning, a bush or a tree. Sometimes you have to cut things off of it to bring more growth.
Great
and
point.
It doesn't seem like it would work that way, but that's exactly how it works. You have to cut things, remove things, even though it can be a painful process, and that's honestly what's going to propel more growth in the relationship.
You talk about the power of secrecy in relationships, and you describe it as the enemy of intimacy. Can you say more about that?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like especially in a marriage, certainly in all relationships, when there is secrecy, that creates a place where dysfunction can grow in a relationship. And secrecy breeds distrust. It breeds a lot of negative things. In particular, as we work with married couples, we say marriage is one of these very, very few and unique relationships. I believe there's really no place for secrets. And in a lot of ways, that's a radical thought, because we think, well, I don't need to share everything with my spouse. But the key is, if you want to have full and complete transparency, honesty, trust, and intimacy with someone, it really does require a secret-free guarantee, I call it, of saying there's no part of my life, there's no part of my mind, my bank account, my schedule that you don't have access to. I'm not going to have hidden passwords that you don't know. I'm not going to engage in activities that I don't want you to find out about. And if we're not willing to do that, and if we do have these certain parts of our life, our time, our money, that we keep as a secret, especially in that marriage relationship, then that area of secrecy is going to be the very place where dysfunction and distrust start to grow in the relationship. And often when we're working with a couple and there's just not growth happening in a relationship, it's almost like there's this glass ceiling on how high, how far they can grow, and they just feel stuck in a rut. One of the first questions that I like to ask is, well, is there any area of your relationship, of your life, that you're not being fully honest and transparent with each other about? Is there any place where there might be some secrets that need to come out into the open? Because when those exist, they always have a way of holding back the relationship from growing as fast as it should. So yeah, honesty paves the way to intimacy in every relationship, but especially for those of you who are married, I challenge you, and it might be uncomfortable, it might create some uncomfortable conversations, but it's in those conversations that you tend to grow the most. I challenge you to get it all out there. Anything that your spouse doesn't know about your life, your thoughts, share that with them. And I think you'll be amazed at what that can do, because even a painful truth is always better than a hidden lie. And so get it out in the open.
Now, you know, walking along that same path of sort of taking secrecy out of an intimate relationship, there needs to be some trust there that the person who is perhaps holding the secret believes that he or she can trust the partner to hear the secret. So how do you, I mean, there's a reason why people in relationships have secrets. And there can
sure.
be all kinds of reasons. I mean, one of them can be, you know, your mother taught you never to tell your partner anything about anything, which speaks to kind of like mother's secrets, doesn't it? But,
sure.
you know, it really can mean a lot of things. But when trust is not there, or if trust is wavering, then it's really hard to disclose secrets. So let's talk about trust. How do you build trust in a relationship?
That's a great question. And that it might be the single most important question as it relates to building a strong relationship, because the level of your trust, that determines the level that you're going to have in that relationship. And so if there isn't trust there, first off, I think you have to start asking yourself, why? Is there an habitual pattern of saying, I struggle to trust at all because I've been wounded in my past, and am I carrying over some of those wounds from my past? And now this person I'm in a relationship right now, in many ways, is paying for the mistakes of people that are from my past. And do I need to work through some of those issues individually so that I can be in a place where I can be more vulnerable and transparent and trusting? Or do I not trust because this person has broken my trust? And so identifying kind of where the source of the distrust comes from is the first step. And then as far as building trust itself, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book because it is such a huge issue. The only way to build trust, and it's a word that we've used earlier on in this conversation, is consistency. You can break trust or damage trust in a moment by one act, by one word, by one thing that you did that you shouldn't have done. But building trust or rebuilding it takes consistency. It takes time. And so when trust has been broken in a relationship, what I encourage people to do is to recognize that forgiveness and trust are two different things. You need to give your forgiveness instantly, because grace is something that cannot be earned. It can only be given. And forgiveness doesn't mean that the offense didn't hurt or that person is off the hook. Forgiveness simply means, I love you enough, even though you've broken my trust, to pursue healing instead of punishment. And yes, this wounded us both. And yes, this is going to take a long time to recover from. But I'm giving you my forgiveness so that I'm not held back by bitterness, and I'm not held back by holding a grudge that's going to poison us both. And I'm creating the opportunity for trust to be rebuilt here. And then it's on that other person who broke the trust to earn it. You cannot earn forgiveness, but you absolutely have to earn trust. And by their consistency of their actions and their words over time, that trust will slowly be rebuilt. It doesn't happen all at once. But if forgiveness paves the way for the opportunity to happen, for trust to be rebuilt, and depending on the nature of the offense, it depends on, you know, how long it might take to rebuild, but the consistency is the only way to do it.
All righty. Dave Willis, author of The 7 Laws of Love. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to talk about the naked marriage. Don't go away. Dave Willis, author of The Seven Laws of Love, Essential Principles for Building Stronger Relationships. What on earth is a naked marriage?
Well, it's fun, first of all.
Okay.
I think that married couples could stand to be naked more often, you know, personally. Someone was asking, like, what's the key to surviving, like, arguments in marriage, and just saying, joking, but then afterwards thinking, you know, that actually isn't a bad idea. I said, well, if you're going to disagree, just get naked first. It's almost impossible to be naked and angry at the same time. So, but that's a whole different conversation. But I'm telling you, it's probably not bad advice. I think your arguments would look totally different if you're both.
I think you're 1,000% right, actually.
And you start looking at each other and smiling and thinking, what were we arguing about anyway?
Exactly. Goes out the window.
Exactly. So that's step one. Now, the naked marriage just paints the picture of transparency on every level. And obviously, in a marriage relationship, the physical nakedness is part of it. You know, the sexual aspect of the relationship, the intimate aspect of the relationship, that's a very important part of it, and that requires nakedness. But my challenge to couples is to view that nakedness not only as a physical act, but to try to imagine what would our relationship look like if our very souls were naked with one another. And I'm convinced that is God's intention for marriage. And what that means is a lot of the things we've talked about of not having secrets, because nakedness paints a picture of saying, I've got nothing to hide from you. You know, you see everything that I have, you know, the good parts, the parts that might not be as appealing, you see it all. And that's where intimacy is really born, in that kind of transparency and vulnerability. And so, yes, it's important physically to be naked and to prioritize the sexual intimacy that happens in a marriage. But it's also important to say, I want our very souls, our emotions, our thoughts to be naked. I don't want to wear a filter around you. I don't want to hide things from you. I want you to know exactly what I'm thinking and exactly what I'm feeling. And for this marriage to be a safe place where both of us can express our fears, our doubts, our joys, our concerns, and that we can walk with each other through whatever life throws our way, knowing that we've got each other's back. And so that in a nutshell is what it means to have a naked marriage.
And, you know, again, what I'm hearing is the power and the value of trust in that naked marriage. The best advice ever. You've got a section in the Seven Laws of Love that is entitled The Best Marriage Advice Ever. And one of the things that I wish we had time to go through all of them, but we don't. You say, don't put your marriage on hold while you're raising your children, or you will wind up with an empty nest and an empty marriage. And we know that there are people who do that, who pour their entire selves almost into their children and kind of forget about the spouses. Talk to those folks, if you would.
Well, it's true. And I think that it comes from a good place. I mean, parents that get into that mindset, they're not willingly out to sabotage their marriage. They're doing what they believe is best for the kids. They think, well, we're adults, we're fine, we can put our relationship on hold and give all the focus to our kids. And in their minds, they're thinking that's what it takes to be the best parents we can be. But really, the best gift that you can give to your kids, I'm convinced, is modeling for them what it means to be in a healthy and vibrant marriage, by having the kind of marriage that actually makes them want to grow up and get married someday, instead of making them want to run as far away as they can from the idea of marriage because, you know, they saw two people in the home who never got along and were just kind of, you know, roommates at best, and sometimes just argued every time they were around each other, and the only thing they had in common were the kids. And we're seeing this huge surge of divorces that are happening among middle-aged adults after their kids move out of the home, and they kind of look at each other and realize, we don't even know each other anymore. You know, we've been so focused on the children And in our minds, we thought, well, once the kids are out of the house, then we can focus on us again. But by that time comes, they've grown apart so much that they don't even know where to begin, and they think that they'd be better off just calling it quits and starting over with someone else. So what we encourage, you know, couples to do, especially those of you who are in the exhausting years of raising young children. It's a beautiful season, but it's tough, and I'm right there with you. I get it. I get that it can be so hard to have uninterrupted time just for mommy and daddy during those years, but it is well worth the effort. I think one of the best things Ashley and I have done for our marriage, you know, even in those times when we were financially strapped, even when it took a lot of creativity to pull it off, we prioritized a date night. You know, and we had the goal of doing it once a week. It didn't always happen, but at least a couple times a month, we would get a babysitter. We would put that night on the calendar, and we would look forward to it. Just knowing it was coming would give us encouragement. And when it came, we didn't do anything that was glamorous. A lot of times we'd grab something to eat. We would just go on a walk. We would talk. We would just spend that time together. And it has done wonders over the years. That consistent habit has done wonders for our relationship. Even the nights that you can't do that, though, put the kids to bed, and you and your spouse just, you know, sit on the couch, give each other a foot rub, turn off the phones and the electronics, and just talk, just reconnect at the end of the day. Make that a priority, and do it daily, because if you'll invest in your marriage daily, especially in those years when you're raising a family, it's going to make your marriage stronger. It's going to ultimately make your family stronger, and it's going to create the kind of marriage that will last long after the kids have grown up and moved out of the house.
And if you think about it, you know, you've got your kids in your house for at least 18 years, if not longer. That's a long time not to pay attention to the commitment that you've made to each other.
Absolutely.
Speaking of date nights, you actually have a list of 21 date night questions. And some of them, actually, they're all really wonderful, but they're so thought-provoking. If there was a movie about your life, what songs would you want on the soundtrack? That's a really fascinating question. And it's the kind of question, as they all are, where you really can't watch TV and just pay attention to this on the commercials. You really do need to cut off the electronics and just give thoughtful, honest, naked answers, if you will.
Oh, it's so true. And I think asking questions like that, it bonds you together so much, because marriage is a lifelong voyage of discovering new things about each other. You're both constantly learning and growing. So there's constantly more to learn about each other. And we can never think, oh, well, she knows me, I know her, I know him, we've got it all figured out. But keep growing, keep learning about yourselves, and keep learning about each other. And so those questions are just another fun way to have some of those conversations that'll bring laughter, and then also to ultimately bind you closer together as a husband and wife.
I'm just going to share another couple of the questions. What was your biggest fear when you were a child? And then what is your biggest fear now? That kind of question can open up so much communication between the two of you.
It absolutely can. Yeah, it can create, you know, some of them are going to bring laughter and a lot of surprising answers. And some of them are designed to create some very thought-provoking, vulnerable answers that can tap into some of our deepest desires and our deepest fears, and to invite each other into those spaces where very few people have ever been. And that creates a real intimacy.
Absolutely. I'm just going to share one more of the date night questions. If you could write one new law that everyone had to obey, what law would you create? Now, that's got to bring some fascinating answers.
I'm sure. I'm sure that it would. And we might get some good laws out of it. So who knows? Who knows what could happen?
We could probably stand some good laws. That's true. You spend a fair amount of time talking about the impact of fear on your relationships, and you encourage the reader to really think about and allow themselves to heal from the past, to question whether or not they have their past in their present. and then to really focus on fear and how it shows up now. In the just couple of moments that we have left, and I know it's not a fair question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Talk about a way that one might approach examining the fears that have impacted or currently impact one's relationship.
Yeah, I think that is such an important question that each of us has to wrestle with, because we've all been wounded. We all carry with us a past, and that past has some high points, some beautiful moments, but each of our pasts also carries with it some scars, some parts that we're not proud of, either because it reflects poor choices that we made, or it reflects poor choices that others made that wounded us. And often that happened back when we were most vulnerable in our childhood. And in childhood, I always say, you know, a child's heart and mind is like wet cement, and the impressions that are made there early on have a tendency to harden over time, and we start to see ourselves in the world in view of some of these things that were said and done to us as children. And when those were positive, of course, that can have a lot of positive benefit. But when those were negative, when we were, you know, victims of any kind of abuse or neglect, and it can create such deep wounds that we're tempted to not let anyone get too close to us because we're afraid that in doing so, it's gonna re-enter that part that has caused so much pain that it could reopen those wounds. And we would rather keep others at arm's distance. We would almost rather go through life never being fully known or fully loved, because if we were, it might cause that pain, and one of our deepest fears is reliving that pain. And so we need to get to a place where we can be honest about those fears and about our own, you know, our fears of rejection and our fears of abandonment, and just the deep fears that even into adulthood many of us carry, to be able to talk about those and to be able to realize how some of those fears are unknowingly impacting the way that we make our decisions and the way that we interact with the people that we love. And it takes courage. It takes courage to face those fears head on and to be able to talk about them, to be able to confront them. But in doing so, it brings freedom. When you shine a light onto a place in our lives that has been living in the darkness for so long, it gives us control over something that's had control over us. And it can create a new level of not only courage within us, but it can create a new level of intimacy in our relationships when we're willing to have those kinds of conversations.
Dave Willis, I have to thank you so much, certainly for the very thoughtful book that you've written, The 7 Laws of Love, Essential Principles for Building Stronger Relationships. Our time is pretty much up today, but I'm wondering if you could share with us a website address for folks to get more information.
Absolutely. Well, first off, Pamela, thank you for having me on the program. I've loved our conversation, and I love what you're doing, and it's been an honor to be part of this. And as far as website, thank you, those who are listening. You can find me online at davewillis.org, where I write almost daily about relationships. And if you're married or engaged, we have a separate site specifically for marriage resources, and that is at strongermarriages.com.
Okay, and that's Stronger Marriages, because there are other sites that where the addresses are close, so I want to make sure that folks get the correct the correct spelling for yours. It's strongermarriages.com, yes?
That's correct.
Yes.
That is correct.
And for Dave Willis, it's DaveWillis. Dave,
yes,
again,
that is.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the work that you're doing. It's wonderful, important work. Thank you.
Well, thank you as well. God bless.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.